we're good in the core subjects, math and science.
Oh, yes, all that. I managed to do all right in the basics, and I did all right in college, you know. I never excelled as far as college, but I was, the first 2 years I didn't do very well. I was pledging one semester, and I played around a lot. But the second 2 years, I was extremely focused. And my GPA went up to 3.2s, 3.5s, 3.8s a semester. I mean, I was burning. But you know, when I got to my sophomore year, the end of my sophomore year, I looked at myself, George, you know, it's time for you to get out of school. So my total focus was to get out of school. I graduated on time, 4 years, you know, and you know, before my junior year, I applied to Peace Corps, and I was accepted in Peace Corps, so I knew where I wanted to. It was my junior year, early part of my senior year. I knew where I wanted to. I went and did my interview stuff, went out to Denver, this and that, and you know, so one and a half months after I finished college, bam, I was 4,000 miles away. It was interesting too, how my family looked at that. I've been fairly much of a black sheep to start off with, because I have always been a little bit more confrontational than my other brothers and sisters, and that conflict carried on to my dad, because my dad had a set of goals, and sometimes he chose to tell me one thing and then tell me another thing in a week. And I would confront him about that. You know, we had a heated argument. I was managing about five or six people, and then one day he chewed me out for managing people and not working. The next week he chewed me out for working and not managing people. So we had a heated argument where I thought he was about going to hit me. You know, he didn't hit me, but just the same, we had a heavy discussion. You know, my family, especially my mom, thought that he'll be back home. He'll be back home in 2 weeks, a month. And 2.5 years later, I show up, you know. But you know, I was never easily deterred from making a goal and then putting that goal as my priority in my life. You know, and you know, this house right here, this house I designed 5 years before I built it. And Lynn and I, during the process, had heated discussions on how we needed to do it. We had various things that we wanted to accomplish in the design work. We had a piano that we had never had a good place for in our previous house. We wanted to accent it. I had art that was stored for years, 10, 15 years, and never could display it. So we worked out everything. We took every house that we had ever owned, every house that I had built, incorporated into a design. And then we had heated arguments over the fireplace. Fireplace cost me $8,000. Linda said, spend the money, George. I said, no, I don't want to spend the money. I want to put an insert in there. But she won't. I love that fireplace. Yeah. I love it now.
Big, beautiful stone fireplace.
Yeah, but you know, I didn't want to spend the money. Fiscal responsibility. But you know, she pushed me into it, and I knew I would love it because I loved the other one that I had. I had another house with a fireplace, but cost. I had overruns in this house, and so the in general, you know, though I've been the black sheep of my family, I have done things that no one had ever comprehended that one I would enjoy, or that you could stereotype black folk in doing. I don't know of any black mountain climbers, for example. And I'm not a mountain climber. If it's a walk-up mountain, I'll get up it. But I've done the Simeon Mountains, Gray and Torrey Peaks in Colorado. I've tried Bierstadt in Colorado. I did a peak in Peru. I climbed a volcano in Zaire. I did the Simeon Mountains, and I did Kilimanjaro.
Wow. I'd say you're a mountain climber.
I did rim to rim on the, I've done the Grandfather Mountain twice. I've done rim to rim on the Grand Canyon, and I don't know what's next, but I'm going to try to do something next.
Wow.
I'm the only one in my family that's an avid hunter. I've hunted since I was a child. and I hunted on my grandfather's land, rabbit and squirrel and quail. And so, you know, I hunt now. My trophies are all over there and everywhere. I design special features in my house to accommodate the few guns, because my wife has never been a gun person, but I'm an advocate, and I make sure that my guns stay extremely protected, as well as never visible. So I am very conscientious about some of the things that I do, and I am a traveler. I've been to 35 countries. I've lived in four. I've been to three coups d'etats and one invasion. I've almost been killed several times in Africa, where guns have been pointed at me. My wife in Liberia. The day before Samuel K. Doe killed Tuckert, we were at a religious program. It was the performance of Hallelujah at one of the local churches. And Tuckert, the president of Liberia, this is in Monrovia, was at that performance. When Tuckert left the performance, my wife almost insisted that she tried to shake his hand. And I was very adamant, you do not ever go to a crowd anywhere in Africa. These are things that I had learned as Peace Corps, where nine people died when the governor of Peace Corps left. And I was 300 yards away, and I can still remember the sound of bullets flying over my head. Okay? Nine people died that day. And so that taught me one of the most important lessons. Always have street savvy sense anywhere, any world that you're in, any country that you're in. You must have street savvy sense. And I pulled my wife away. We will not go over there. And she was upset about this, because she had an opportunity to shake the hand of the president. That night, they killed Tuckert. And the next day, we found out he had been killed. But about a week later, we had found out that they were planning to kill him at the church.
Where you were?
Where we were. And the only reason they didn't kill him was the crowd. Linda could have been in that crowd. Okay? During that time, I moved from my house after the coup d'etat had started. I moved my house to the political director's house across the street from me. So I moved there with my family. So we were staying at his house along with many other people, including Dennis, which was the UN representative from Liberia. He was a Liberian UN representative. Well, a bunch of soldiers came and wanted to break into my house and take my vehicle. My wife begged me not to go outside. The political officer told me not to go outside. I was too stupid to not take their warning. I had a problem with somebody taking something from me and not putting up a fight. So I went out there, and the soldiers were out there, and they wanted to take my vehicle. Well, they couldn't take my vehicle anyway because I had disabled it. I had taken the rotary cup out and distributed it. And so, in that process, I talked to them. They talked to me. I told them, don't break in my house. That's my house. And I was a representative of the United States government. And they said, we will break in your house, blah, blah, this. But they talked. When people talk, they're not going to hurt you. All right? As long as they talk. When they start pulling up their guns. Well, one of the soldiers walked behind me, and I saw him through the corner of my eye, and he was like 5 foot from me, shot his M16 up in there. Knowing that he was behind me, I was prepared for it, and I didn't flinch. I just kept on talking.
No.
They didn't take my vehicle. They didn't break into my house. When I went back into the house, the political officer's house where I was staying, my wife was in a disastrous state. She was crying. She had thought that they had killed me.
And she heard the gunfire.
And I remember it like it was yesterday. Because I recognize now how stupid I was. Because nothing in my house was valuable. Nothing in there was worth my life. But, like I said, I was young and I was stupid. 5 days later, Dennis gave himself up the next day. He was on the beach on a pole being executed. They executed 12 people that day.
Oh,
wow. And it was a mistake for him to give himself up. But he gave himself up.
Oh, boy.
And he walked out. The troops, the soldiers took him, and he was there. So, after that, I started, you know, Africa has changed now to a total different country. And so, I will go to Africa now on vacation. In fact, I'm planning 1.5 years from now, a safari, and to attempt to do Kilimanjaro again with my grandbaby. But it is a vacation spot. It is never going to be my home. I went to the coup d'etat when Haile Selassie was overthrown. I was in a coup d'etat in Liberia. I was in a riot, an invasion by South Africa when I was in Lesotho. All three of my, I stayed and lived in 4 countries in Africa, but all three of them, I was involved in some kind of military action, or near some kind of military action. In Lesotho, I slept under my bed and there were helicopter gunships flying over my house.
Why did you stay in Africa under those circumstances?
Well, it was, you know, today is fine. Tomorrow can happen anything. I didn't anticipate Togo was going to be overthrown. Liberia was a very solid country. Haile Selassie had ruled Ethiopia for 30 years. I mean, you know, he was the president of Ethiopia when the Italians invaded it in 39. And so, you know, this is 72. I mean, it was considered a stable country, African country. You know, you never know what's gonna happen. So you know, I enjoyed my stay there. I was very productive in what I was doing. I enjoyed my work. It was very fulfilling for me. But you never know what's gonna happen in society. You know, I think Africa has changed because of this middle, the degree of poverty that exists now, that has overwhelmed Africa. But in general, it's not the same place that I know and have lived in for a long period of time. I hitchhiked from Ethiopia to Ghana, taking me 6 months. In that 6 month period, I slept in a bed 4 times a month, and I lived off of $50 a month.
Wow.
Okay. But during that whole time, there was only one incident. There was two incidents that I ran into that was very dangerous. But in general, Africa was a very safe place, and it has moved from that now. And if you follow what's happening in Zimbabwe, and I never went to Zimbabwe, but if you follow what's happening in Zimbabwe, it's pitiful. As you can see, I'm fairly aware of international events almost anywhere in the world. I follow stuff like that. I'm a world traveler. I'm a world traveler. You know, there is so many places I want to go. My wife has been with me in many of these places. One of my last major trips that I did was to Peru. Now, this is the third time I'm going to Peru, but it is a return to a goal that I made the first time. The first time I went with my son-in-law and I had decided to do the Inca Trail. Well, the Peru's politics had changed and it had changed to the negative and during the next preceding years. And so I never got to do the Inca Trail. Well, my son-in-law and I went back after 3 years and did the Inca Trail. And Inca Trail is a 4-day 29-mile walk with a 25-pound pack.
Wow.
So that's what both of us did. And we went to over a 14.3 mountain in Peru. So it was a very difficult trip, but it was one of the most enjoyable experiences for my son-in-law, which I was delighted to have an opportunity to convince him to do that. And now he is working on my grandbaby, who is 12, so that we can do other trips like that, and I can involve him in a little bit more outdoors. Because this is the first time, he's a city boy, so he's the first time he ever did anything like that. And you know, he came up to the plate, you know. Walking over a 14K mountain is not an easy task. And, you know, he accomplished it. He's a very fit, very intelligent person, and he enjoyed it. And so I'm looking forward to attempting to do Kilimanjaro, which is, on the stages of mountains, the Inca Trail is a 5, and Kilo is an 8. No, Kilo is a 10, as far as mountains I have achieved. So we're talking about double the situation. And so I don't know if I can make it at 62. I made it at 48, but I don't know if I can make it at 62. But my goal is to attempt it. You know, my goal at 48 was to reach the highest point, and I was not deterred from that, okay? There were many people that attempted the mountain that did not have my mindset, and they failed. One out of every 100, 10 make it to the top.
Wow.
And I was one of those 10.
Wow.
I mean, one of those individuals that made it to the top. But there were other individuals that I thought had a better physical training they were better prepared. I think they were as prepared as I was. Okay, but they didn't make it. Okay, I was as prepared as my body could make me. You know, I trained 6 months, and the last week, 2 weeks before I was doing it, I was doing 9 miles with a 25-pound pack 3 times a week.
Wow.
And the 25 pack is not what I carried of mine. I carried 2 packs. Okay, I carried a water jar, but. You can't get prepared to go up to 19,000 feet if you aren't loading yourself down with weight at 6,000 feet or 4,000 feet. So my goal in preparation is to carry as much as I can and to go as light as I can when I actually do it. So my training was to get me prepared to carry 25 pounds for 9 miles to go uphill 9 miles. With 2 pounds when I got to do the mountain.
And that's the equivalent.
Yes, that was my equivalent. Yeah. That was my equivalent. And that is still what I do now. Every mountain that I do, I don't necessarily do 9 miles, I do 7. But I'm also 59.
You're moving forward.
I'm moving forward. I do, and what I do is I go up to Boone and hit Grandfather, where at least I go up to 8,000. And the trails up there, Profile and Grandfather Trail and all of those up there that goes into the Grandfather Mountain are a good training exercise to prepare me for whichever mountain I'm going to do. And that's the same thing I did with my son-in-law. When we did actually go hit the trail, we hit Boone first. We did 8,000 to get us ready for 14, and we did it with 25 pounds. Now, we did the 14 with 25 pounds, but it was a four-day walk, so you had a little climatization that you did in the process of doing the 14K. So you had 4 days to do it, and the second day you ascended, but we were in Cusco, which is the Incan capital of Peru, and it is at 12. So just walking around climatizes you some.
So you've certainly covered a lot of ground, you've lived in a lot of places, you've done a lot of traveling, but clearly you have many more plans for the future and other places you want to go and places you want to return to, and so just going to keep on going.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
It doesn't sound like you have any plans for retirement or
kicking
back at any time.
After I do, if I make it, if I live, one of the things that the Bible tells you is to always never assume that the next day is there. Always to thank God. So if God willing, okay, my goal is to do Kilimanjaro at 62. Now, having said that, I think that will be my last mountain. It will not be my last travel situation, because I hope to travel till I make it. But I don't think I will be attempting mountains after that. I will still go on long walks. I will do trails and stuff like that, especially trails that have a view. I mean, one of the most beautiful experiences, and I tell people like Kilimanjaro and I would think Serengeti, I've had two experiences that took my breath away. The first experience is seeing the pyramids in Egypt. Now, the pyramids in Egypt was a childhood dream. At age 8, my daddy bought a television bought a television. And the television was cut off at our house at 8 o'clock. I would sneak into the television room, cut it on, and be that far from the screen and watch television at night while my parents were asleep. During that process, I saw the pyramids. And I swore then that I would go see the pyramid. I'm only 18 years old. And I swore then that I would go see the pyramids as a child. And I had never forgotten that. And that started my dream of being, you know, seeing many parts of the country. And then I started fulfilling that dream after I got in college, of course. But that started that process. But when I saw the pyramids, it took my breath away. I forgot to breathe. It was so beautiful. And there is one other thing, place that I was, and that was to see the Grand Canyons. The Grand Canyons was phenomenal. I mean, it was so beautiful that to see something that had been created so many years ago, that like I said, it took my breath away. I have only on a few other occasions have that to happen to me. I climbed in 74, in August of 74, I was on my knees at 12 o'clock at night in the pitch dark, climbing a volcano outside of Bukavu and Goma, Zaire. And the volcano is probably at 8,000 feet, and they had a hut at 6 or 7. And so at 12 o'clock at night, you went outside and you basically got on your hands and knees and climbed up the mountain by about 1,000 feet. It might not have been 1,000, it might have been 400 feet. It's hard, my memory is not what it used to be. I still remember. And at that particular time, I had a telephoto lens. And as you crest over the volcano, you could look down in the volcano and you could see the molten lava popping up. And it was awesome. And one of the things that happened in that was that I could hook up my telephoto lens and shoot down in it. I still have slides of that up in my thing that I show people when we have entertainment. When I have entertainment at the house, I will often take up and put slideshows of my Kilimanjaro experience or my years of living in Africa, or the volcano that I climbed, or something. But you know, I show slides of some of the things I did. All my children when they were babies running around, you know, so cute. But that's some of the experiences that are still as vivid as having done it yesterday. Mm. And so I look at going to see the wall in China. I look at, there's a fall in Venezuela I would like to hit. There's quite a few other things that I would like to do that will probably have some of the same effect on me.
All far away from Cary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. From my humble beginnings.
Yes. But still, and your life work is here, so... Mm-hmm. There's a lot for you here in Cary, as well as out there in the whole world to see and experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, when I go into Evans Estates, I kind of smile.
You should. It's beautiful. Yeah. You've accomplished a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Evans Estates. My brother and I, which was my partner in Evans Estates, am very proud of, and I'm very proud of what is to come as far as the next development and the next development. You know, because we're not done yet. And, you know, we will involve our children in part of that. You know, one of the things that has happened is that my grandfather was an entrepreneur. Now, let's start off with Charlie. Charlie was an entrepreneur. He was a horse doctor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He was a horse trader, horse doctor, took care of horses and this, and his wife. And the odd thing about it, and most people don't know that there was a lot of intermarriage between people in the 1800s. You know, it was not just a black and white or Indian society. What happened, the Evanses came from England, married whites here, married Indians here. Indians married blacks here, married whites here. My grandfather, Charlie, my great-great-grandfather, Charlie, was Indian and Paul white. His wife was white. Okay? Now, the children of them, which is my grandfather, married Indian, all black, and then our other generation have married Indian, white, black, whatever, you know, but we're you know, the world is a very complicated place, and America is now, can't afford to be colorblind, because we're all of color. So, it's you know, like I said, that the our history is very fascinating, very fascinating.
It is.
But we only represent, no, what we represent truly is part of the history of America. And that history is white, it is black, it is Indian. If anything, I am all three in what would be considered by most a militant attitude. You know, because I grew up on the black power. And I have always, you know, like I said, associated myself with that power movement. And that is not necessarily true of our younger people. And that is not necessarily true of our older people. Because there was no movement.
So you've lived in a very exciting time.
Oh, yeah.
And have seen just vast changes mm-hmm. in the culture, in the laws, in the attitudes, mm-hmm. And it's hopefully continuing to change, and hopefully, because we still have a long way to go, mm-hmm. but we have come mm-hmm. a ways.
It was interesting what Obama said. He says in his interview last night that being a black president lasted for one day after he took office, and then it's whoever you are, perform. I thought that was sort of interesting in that, you know, you may say, okay, he is our first black president, but whatever he is, I, you know, at this particular point, I want him to solve the economy. I don't care whether he's green. You know, it doesn't make any difference to me. And I did not vote for Obama because he was black. I voted for him because I thought he had the best approach toward the solving our problem. I thought he moved us from the age of big money and buying politicians to the age of being fiscally responsible. And I'm not in agreement with all of what he's saying because I'm a conservative Democrat. But I have a twofold side of this thing. I also know that the experiences that America is going through is not black and white. It is tremendously Americans' experience. Because, you know, I'm in a place in and, you know, I'm a business owner first. And as a business owner, we are in the construction industry and in the land development industry, we are devastated. Yeah. I am just blessed that I did not get caught out there owing millions when this thing happened. I am on the downside toward retirement, and I had reduced my exposure, and I became liquid with most of my assets. And therefore, I am able to weather this most difficult storm. But this most difficult storm has major effects on how I deal with it. You know, I wanted to go bear hunting this year. I don't have the money for it. I do not have the money for it. There is so many, you know, like I said, it's affecting everybody. It's terrible out there. It's terrible out there. And, you know, I look in the paper, and people don't realize this. I'm a SunTrust banker. I spent $20 million with SunTrust over my business career, or more. And the article in the paper is exactly what SunTrust did with me. They saw, they jammed me on one of my construction loans. I never missed a payment throughout my entire history of it. And I might have missed one, and that's because I misplaced the paperwork. Okay? But I never missed a payment. I'm one of the A1 clients, though a small client. And if you read the article in the paper, they did exactly what they did to the all. They ran all of the builders out of business. And I saw it coming, and I switched to another bank. And so I just switched my loan and did not let them own me.
Boy.
But they attempted to own me. And some of my friends, builders,
got caught
where they confiscated some of their liquid cash because they knew they had, even though I had never missed a payment. And my problem is, SunTrust, in doing that, what they did is reduce the ability of the builder to cover the debt over a long period of time, because they're going after the liquid cash that builders have and reducing they're increasing their exposure on the market, because they got their cash. If you haven't read the article, it's an interesting phenomenon that's happening with banks. And it's one that I didn't anticipate being a very good client of SunTrust.
Right.
I think I've talked too much.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered all the questions.
Yeah. But I think you need to sit down with my brother. I think my brother will give a different facet on it.
Okay, now have you had a chance to talk to him? When I called him the other night, he hadn't talked to you yet about who I was and what I was trying to do.
Yes, I did mention your name, and he said he called.
Yeah. He said he was willing to be interviewed and that I should give him a call. Mm-hmm. When I'm ready, and we'll see if we can find a time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do that in the next few
days.
And
did you ever interview Jeanette Evans?
No, I haven't. Would she be a good person?
Well, Jeanette lived through the experience, and her husband, she lived through the experience of Evans Road widening, of course. And,
yes.
And my family went through that experience. But see, we didn't get jammed. Evans Road widening was a positive.
Yeah.
Where it was very negative for a lot of people. I was looking for my address right here.
Okay. Now, how is she related to you? She's in Evans as well, right?
Yeah, I'll show you.
Okay.
My grandfather and her husband's grandfather were brothers.
Okay. Also, do you know who Lucille Evans Cotton is?
That name sounds familiar.
Does it? Yeah, we interviewed her. Your uncle didn't know who she was, but she was one of the first six black girls who started at Cary High School, the
mm-hmm.
first year that it was integrated. And I just wondered where she fit into your family, if you knew.
Okay, here we are.
Okay.
Otis Nazi Evans is one of the kids of Charlie and Matilda.
Okay.
Now here's my grandfather right here, Clyde Evans.
Clyde.
So that's when he went. His wings start off right here, and then his father was Levis Evans, which is the son of Otis Nazi Evans, and then here's Herbert Evans right here.
Okay, so Levis.
Mm-hmm.
And then Herbert.
Yeah, and then Herbert Evans. And Jeanette Evans is his wife.
Okay.
Herbert is still alive, but he has Alzheimer's, and he's on hospice now.
Oh, boy. Okay, yeah, I think someone had told me that he was ill, and so I hesitated calling her because of that.
Well, I think, having to go through Alzheimer's has prepared her. I think she's at peace. I'll tell you what, I'll call her first.
Okay.
So she knows well.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah. That'd be great. Okay.
Oh, there it is right here. I know I don't have, I always have my phone within hands distance of it. Peggy, I know I went off of the topic a great deal.
Well, but that's fascinating.
I had an interesting life.
Yes, you have had, and I really appreciate you telling me all about it and for giving these interviews to us. So this has been really helpful, and I appreciate you taking the time and to meet with me today.
Mm-hmm.